Major support for Out to Lunch is provided by the law firm of Jones Walker, established in 1937 with over 375 attorneys in offices throughout the U.S., providing a comprehensive range of services to a local, national, and international client base. JonesWalker.com. And by Hancock Whitney, with more than 120 years of experience helping clients protect the financial future they deserve, even in these challenging times. Hancock Whitney, your dream, our mission. And by Shorten Associates, legal recruiters in Louisiana and Texas.
From across Louisiana, we're out to lunch with Peter Ricchiuti, Stephanie Regal, and Christian Mader. Peter Ricchiuti is Tulane University's Freeman School of Business Professor of Finance. Stephanie Regal is editor of the Baton Rouge Business Report. Christian Mader is publisher and editor of The Current. It's business Louisiana style.
Hi, and welcome to Out to Lunch Louisiana. I'm Christian Mader in Lafayette.
I'm Peter Ricchiuti in New Orleans.
I'm Stephanie Regal in Baton Rouge. As Louisiana reopens and we continue to navigate the fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic, Christian, Peter, and I are taking a weekly statewide look at what's happening in the world of business and finance.
Today, we're going to be joined by Judy Terzodis, the publisher of the daily newspaper, The Advocate. The newspaper has editions in New Orleans, Baton Rouge, and Acadiana, and Lindsay Navarro. She's the executive director of El Centro, an organization that supports Louisiana's Latinx entrepreneurs.
But let's start in Baton Rouge, Stephanie, where I understand maybe the pandemic that we've been experiencing over the last few months feels like it might be kind of ending there. At least that's the attitude the business community might have. What's going on in Baton Rouge?
Well, you know, Christian, you really get that sense that people are just willing things to be back to normal here. And so the thing that's going to be curious is does it work, right? I mean, are we going to see a huge resurgence in the middle of the summer? Or will things really go back to as close to normal as we can get? I mean, I'm not saying that people outside of the conservative members of the state legislature are not taking precautions, because businesses very definitely are. But, I mean, you're really seeing a resumption of commercial activity. I was touring a mixed-use traditional neighborhood development last week, and, I mean, construction is blowing and going there. They've been selling new houses in the moderate to upper end segment of the market, you know, homes in the $600,000-$800,000 range, at least one a week at the slowest part of the pandemic. So that sort of gives you an idea of where things are. You know, as pools reopen and camps reopen, people are out and about. And the restaurants and the bars, even though they're still under, you know, the phase two guidelines that limit the number of people they can have in there, it really doesn't look like there's a whole lot of social distancing going on when you drive by and you see a bunch of people crowded on the patios. They're not wearing masks, and they certainly are standing close together. So whatever the capacity limits are, you know, it looks very much like things are sort of back to normal. In Lafayette, are you seeing that same sort of mentality, you know, among the business community, and how are the small business, how's Main Street Lafayette doing?
The Main Street in Lafayette, in a lot of ways, you know, if you kind of think about the layout of a traditional city, right, is Jefferson Street in downtown Lafayette. And by all accounts, it was back over the weekend. And I, you know, I long ago gave up my evening jaunts, but my understanding is the bars are, you know, kind of starting to come back. You know, downtown, if anything, is kind of known for having a pretty vibrant bar scene, and people, I guess, couldn't fit, you know, all inside of these bars. And so they're sort of spilling into the street. So it's a version of downtown life that certainly existed beforehand, meaning, you know, I can recall, you know, mounted police and things like that trying to deal with crowd control before people weren't sort of allowed to all go inside of a building. But it's still kind of jarring to think that, you know, for a period of time, we were all watching movies and kind of cringing when people were shaking hands. And then now, you know, people are just like crunching into Jefferson Street and bringing out ice chests to go drinking, right? And it doesn't sound like my idea of a good time, but people are doing it again, you know. Peter, I understand that, you know, in New Orleans, right, they're thinking about shutting down the French Quarter to car traffic, which is, you know, actually something that I think is kind of in the ether here, like the idea that maybe they should turn portions of downtown, at least temporarily, into pedestrian walkways. And that's a trend that we're seeing nationally, in fact. I mean, tell us about that. Is the mayor really going to get this done? I mean, it kind of makes sense at face value, right?
Yeah, and you know, one of the things about COVID-19 is we're trying to figure out what is going to be the lasting impacts. The one everybody talks about is that more and more of us are going to be working from home. But this is more of a local issue, and Mayor Cantrell has put together a task force to look at how this would be done to get the cars out of the French Quarter. And I'm sure it would be controversial. In fact, there would be some businesses that it would be a positive for, and some would be a negative. One of the things she said in a press conference was that it would be good for restaurants in that they could now have tables outdoors. And then she also mentioned that street musicians would be not run over. That would be a good thing too. And it's just going to be interesting to see what the business community thinks of all that. And of course, what happens is when you saw the French Quarter completely empty, it just made you reimagine what that place could be in a way that you would never get a chance to see it like that.
You're listening to Out to Lunch Louisiana with Peter Ricchiuti in New Orleans, Christian Mader in Lafayette, and I'm Stephanie Regal in Baton Rouge. Whatever else has happened to you over the past few months, you've more than likely been keeping up with everything that's going on by checking the news. Along with NPR, some of Louisiana's most reliable news sources are the local newspaper, Baton Rouge and Acadiana editions of the Advocate, both in print and online. And in New Orleans, of course, there's NOLA Times-Picayune. The publisher of all the editions is Judy Terzotis. Judy, it's good to see you again. Welcome back to Out to Lunch.
Thank you so much.
And of course, the last time we spoke on this show back in February, which now seems like a lifetime ago, you were talking about how The Advocate was bucking national newspaper trends in the face of shrinking circulations and streamlined newsrooms in other places. The Advocate was actually hiring. It was growing. It had recently acquired the Times-Picayune. It was seeing new revenue streams. And then COVID hit. And now when you go to the Advocate's website, there's an advertisement that says our COVID-19 news team needs your help. And there's actually a donate button. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm listening to public radio when I'm on your site. It's been reported that y'all have had to lay off people and some have had to take pay cuts. What was it about the pandemic that really turned the Advocate from an outlier media success story into a newspaper that's having a tough time?
Yeah, and I still contend we're an outlier. We did what smart business people do is we hunkered down. I will tell you there were days in March where my chief revenue officer came into my office and said, we had $400,000 canceled today. The next day he would come in and say, we had $600,000 canceled today. And I'm not exaggerating. Of course, these are primarily that kind of money is your large national chains who really had to reinvent themselves and how that they're going to market to their best customers. So we did what all businesses do. We looked inward and said, okay, we got to protect our readership. We got to make sure we have robust products. And, you know, we've got to be able to serve our business community. So what can we do differently? We didn't lay people off. We actually put a group of folks on unpaid leave and intend to bring them back. We have been paying 100% of their health insurance, and they could apply for unemployment. Then we took the rest of the staff and put a furlough in place. So not a pay cut. I mean, yes, it's less money, but they're getting time in return. So we launched initially in March of one day a week. So basically a 20% pay cut. And with that, though, I've been able to put back hours as businesses return. Yet you mentioned, you know, we launched a donation campaign, as much most media companies have done across the country, for profit, nonprofit, have put into place. We partner with local media association who has a nonprofit arm, a foundation. All of the donations go 100% to hours in the newsroom to cover COVID-19. Now we're at a place that our journalists are only taking one furlough day a month. So that shows you what has happened since March, where it was one day a week. Now it's only one day for the entire month. And I hope to be able to dissolve that in the next month. And so we've been putting back hours. But yes, you know, we can't just hunker down. So we are also looking forward. And so you'll see now that we have job postings for critical positions that we intend to hire. So it is going to be a return. Thank goodness we got out of the gate very, very strong in Q1. That is really helping us weather the storm. We're learning with the rest of the world about how to reinvent ourselves.
And one of the criticisms that you heard when you all were soliciting donations was that they are privately owned, and they're owned by one of the well-known wealthiest businessmen in the state, right? And he lives on a private gated street in uptown New Orleans. And so how did you all, you know, respond to that when you did hear that criticism?
Yeah, I mean, we're a business, you know, and that we're one of John's businesses that have also his other businesses have been severely impacted. So you run a business like you, a good, strong business should be run, regardless if you're owned by a national chain with, you know, deep, deep pockets, as I used to work for Gannett, you know, and, you know, you just run for the best of the business and making sure that you're making those decisions, regardless of who your owner is.
So in a lot of ways, you know, Judy, you kind of, what you guys seem to have experienced happened to a lot of news organizations across the country, sort of this coronavirus bump, right? Where all of a sudden everybody's interested in the news and yet it doesn't turn into revenue, right? So it raises this kind of interesting question about, you know, from my perspective, right, is that I run a nonprofit media organization. Like, yeah, this is an extreme event, but does it not underscore a severe problem in the way for-profit news organizations are even run? Like the idea that when, if what we're selling is the information that people need, and yet when people need the information the most, we can't turn that into profit, kind of raises some serious questions about the viability long-term, doesn't it?
Well, you know, we launched, as you know, Christian, a digital subscription model a little over a year ago. We did put it on pause when we were bringing in the Times-Picayune and Nolan.com into our organization. So I kind of say it's about a year old, even though it's a little bit more than a year old. We have seen a direct correlation. We're up four times what we were averaging in a given week in digital-only subscriptions. So we're sitting at about 10,000 digital-only subscribers right now, which is way ahead of our projections. It's not enough. It's not good enough. You know, most newsrooms, they're trying to at least get the number of digital-only subscribers to pay one time the payroll for the newsrooms. There's other, you know, other organizations are like, that's not aggressive enough. You need to have enough digital subscriber revenue to double what you're paying in the newsroom to help offset. We also have seen a big increase in digital advertising, which was really the pleasant surprise out of it. Although print has been, you know, it has definitely been impacted on ROP, but our digital advertising has held its own. And then some months in the last few months have actually exceeded our, of course, last year, but also our budgeted numbers. So we're seeing more people are coming to us. So we are seeing a direct correlation with digital subscribers and digital revenue. So it gives us, again, it's, you know, how do you transform a traditional media organization? You better be running as hard as you can into digital. This is forcing us, because we have been a very traditional, you know, news organization, because this Southern corridor still believes in print. And Stephanie and I were talking about that in February. It is, you look anywhere else in the country, and we really, it's very rare to see the kind of print subscriber numbers that we have. On a Sunday, we still have 165,000 print subscribers across three markets. That's big. It's bigger than Nashville. It's bigger than Des Moines. It's bigger than Indy. So we still think print is an important part of our business model, but man, we are doubling down in digital.
Judy, one great business truism is that the first thing that gets cut is advertising. But on the other hand, it's usually the first thing to come back. Are you starting to see some signs of that?
Yes, thank goodness. about probably almost a month ago, we started, you know, really we're trying to get advertisers to talk to us, get ready for when it comes back. Let's have your strategies developed. Let's make sure we have all the tactics in place. And man, they weren't wanting to talk to us in early April. They're like, that sounds nice, but I'm hoping, you know, I'm trying to figure out how I pay my staff or what my business even looks like. So about a month ago, we started getting the, yes, we really need to get going. And so, you know, out of the gate, print revenue was down 48 to 50%. And now looking in June, we'll be down maybe about 25%. So you can see the big, and really national advertisers are, the RFPs are finally coming in. So for July, August, they're, you know, are we banking on a big Q4? Yes, because we do feel like that pent up demand is there. And we have confidence in it because we're seeing the RFP come from, you know, the largest national advertisers. So cautiously optimistic, but I remain very, very concerned about the local retailers, because they are are. It's more important now than ever that we come up with solutions that are going to provide that ROI for them, because I think they're in the fight of their life. And so I feel that that's something that's very important to us, is to make sure we're taking care of our local advertisers.
So Judy, I'm curious, how well did the donation strategy work? I mean, you're kind of going to the public and saying, this is something that we need, right? This is a public service. It's tied to a specific editorial product. I mean, did it plug the gap when you're talking about $1 million in 2 days of lost advertising revenue?
But it certainly plugged ours. I mean, we're sitting right now probably in the 70,000 that we've raised in the last 2 months. Not shabby, right? And continue every day to have, I mean, I go out on, we're using again through LMA, and I can go out in their portal and see, and there's, you know, days that literally we'll get, you know, 30 donations of $25, and some days we'll get $2,000 or $3,000 donations. And what I love, and you'll understand this, Christian, is you also, they're able to write you notes. And I mean, the inspiring things that they're saying about our journalists being on the front line, and, you know, really they count on us and they're supporting us. So it's a piece of the puzzle. We also applied to a number of grants. So Facebook and Google were both very good to us, and, you know, to the tune of about $200,000. So, you know, that's like a pittance to them. That's, you know, that's couch money, right? but we'll take it.
Do you see that continuing, Judy, once things go back to normal? I mean, will you all be looking at new revenue streams like this?
Absolutely. I mean, Stephanie, you and I talked. You remember we talked about events. And so we had $1 million budgeted in event revenue. Yeah, that was an ouchie, because really we're not going to get anywhere near that. And so, you know, we've tried to reinvent ourselves a little bit. We've done virtual town halls with sponsors, but that's like tiny, you know, it really wasn't the big dollars that we really, in terms of diversification, we're going to be able to achieve in that manner. So yes, we continue. And I think, you know, we have a beautiful printing press here in Baton Rouge. And so we're aggressively going after more commercial printing so we can fill up ours. So we're looking at every opportunity for revenue infusion. And I think we're really positioned to do very well this year. I really feel like this dip will come out of it. I'm very confident.
Judy Trezotis is publisher of The Advocate. Judy, thank you so much for joining us today on Out to Lunch Louisiana.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Out to Lunch Louisiana with Stephanie Regal in Baton Rouge, Christian Mader in Lafayette, and I'm Peter Ricciuti in New Orleans. There's no two ways about it. This is a tough time to be in business. There is help available to get through this rough patch in the form of business loans, even grants. Some are through federal agencies, some are through state agencies, and there's money available from city governments in New Orleans and Baton Rouge and Lafayette. Getting a hold of this money is not easy. Typically, businesses benefit from being a member of a business alliance to help them navigate the maze of regulation and bureaucracy. But some businesses are too small to join alliances, like the Chamber of Commerce. For those small owner-operated businesses, getting access to financial expertise is very, very challenging. You might be a great hairdresser, house painter, or plumber, but that doesn't mean you have great or even any business skills. Now imagine having the added problem of not being able to speak English. And that's the position many Latinx self-employed people find themselves today in Louisiana. And that's why there's an organization called El Centro. El Centro provides business assistance for Latinx entrepreneurs. The executive director of El Centro is Lindsay Navarro. Lindsay, welcome Out to Lunch.
Hi, thank you, Peter. It's such a pleasure to be here and truly an honor. It's hard for me to not fangirl in this moment. I love this show, and the opportunity to share, I think, what our organization is doing, is it means a lot to me.
And tell me what the footprint looks like. Are you in parts of Louisiana, all of Louisiana?
Yeah, so we're based out of the greater New Orleans area. To be honest, we've got a partnership with the Mexican consulate. And so I've traveled as far as Lafayette, as far as Lake Charles, up to Baton Rouge as well. And we even have customers who call us all the way out from Shreveport. So we're small but mighty, and the reach is quite broad across the state, just because the need is so great for this resource within the community.
Lindsay, what is the number one question you're getting from these entrepreneurs during this time?
I think a lot of them are looking for capital. I think a lot of them are not sure how they're going to weather this storm. What we've faced a lot of folks, what we're really seeing are the number of business owners who think they have employees, but realize that they have independent contractors. And so when it comes to being eligible for some of this funding, they don't have the payroll to really meet the needs of the company. And so we've seen companies as small as, you know, one person shows, and then folks who are working in construction who have 10 to 15 independent contractors. And so when they're applying for funding like the PPP, they don't quite meet the payroll requirements. And a lot of them had no idea this even existed. A lot of them felt that this wasn't meant for them. They weren't sure if they had to go to the bank or if they had to go to the government. And I think within the Latinx community or the Hispanic community, we have a fear for government. And the responsibility, I think, of even committing to a loan it can be very daunting for some of these folks. And so when, you know, one thing is the application, and the application wasn't actually translated to Spanish until 2 weeks ago. And so while the government was touting this opportunity, it really wasn't language accessible for the community at large. And a lot of folks didn't feel that they were going to meet the requirements, meet the credit threshold either, and they didn't even know where to start. A lot of the Latinx community, a lot are ITIN holders, which means that they're taxpayers, but they may not have authorized work permits, so they can't work as employees. So they then by default are qualified as independent contractors. And so a lot of them didn't see themselves as eligible for some of this funding. So I think educating them in that aspect in and of itself was, you know, demystifying this. For folks to realize, like, hey, I'm eligible, and this money can actually help me, right?
So Lindsay touched on a point that I think a lot of folks have raised about that specific program, namely the Payroll Protection Program, and sort of the gaps that it, the wide gaps that it had for certain businesses that really fell through the cracks, right? So, you know, a concern that we've seen here in Lafayette is, okay, well, where do we send them? Yeah, maybe they can get an economic injury disaster loan, but maybe that's not quite as generous as it would be if I were an employer. I mean, have you found situations where people, you know, really fell through the cracks to the points where we're seeing like lots of business closures? I mean, has it been that damaging, or have you guys been able to really point them in a direction where you can keep them going with a proper bridge loan?
We're not quite there seeing the closures just yet, but I can't say it's inevitable. I think it's going to happen, and I think it's going to be unfortunate. But we try our best to connect folks. And so we're allies, we work very closely with the SBA and very closely with the SBDC. We're essentially that Spanish speaking liaison for the SBDC. And I think preparing folks, for the capital is key. And I think what's happening a lot of times is, a lot of these business owners were bootstrapping. A lot of these business owners, it's their first time accessing capital. And typically you access capital because you want to make a large investment. And in this case, they're just hoping to keep businesses afloat. And so I think it's a very different situation.
So Lindsay, you raise a point though that I wanted to jump on that, because, you know, access to capital and the challenges therein is something we're hearing from a lot of minority business owners now as we're addressing issues related to, you know, the George Floyd protests and whatnot. And that's what you hear from minority business owners all the time, irrespective of the pandemic, right? Is how do they access capital? So, I mean, even in the best of times, at, you know, at a very practical sort of granular level, what can y'all do in El Centro? What do you do to help these really little guys and gals get money?
Yeah, so I would be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to highlight my background is actually in microfinance, and I worked with LifeFund, which is one of the largest microlenders in the nation. And so we're very familiar with alternative lenders. And when I say alternative lenders, most people think we're three-headed monsters and that they're payday lenders, right, or loan sharks. And what we're really trying to do, I think, across the nation is combat that, to educate folks. I think a lot of times business owners think that the big banks are their only option, and they don't really see the difference or the distinction between a large national bank, a regional bank, a community bank, or even a credit union. And so that's that knowledge that the business owner won't have, just because they're great at running their businesses, but they don't have to know where to access capital, right? the goal is for them to connect like an to an organization like ours who can say, look, we'll help you navigate the system. It looks like you're asking the wrong person for money. Let me get you in front of the right person so that you can get the answer that you need.
Lindsay, this is Peter. I don't think people understand how big the Latinx business community is. What kind of numbers should we be throwing around?
Yeah, so statewide, according to the census, the 2010 census, we've got over 15,000, or a little less than 15,000. I think the number was 14,900 something. So a little less than 15,000. And these are folks that are registered businesses. So this doesn't account for the number of people who are sole proprietors, who aren't registered, who are informal businesses. I mean, we have a very large informal economy. When you go to Central and South America, what you see is, I mean, even I have an aunt who sells ice cream from her house, right? And she doesn't necessarily have to go to the city, to the municipality to register that business. And so a lot of folks do that, right? They have that side hustle, like we say here in New Orleans. And that's very real within this economy as well. Coming from a lender background, I hate to say I was tired of denying people. And I realized if I can just put my knowledge to good use and prepare folks to have this conversation, then we can really get them the access to capital that they need. And whether that is a business loan or even a mortgage, we've managed to identify those lenders who are willing to work within the community to help make those exceptions so that these folks can build what we call in Spanish patrimonio, or that equity.
Lindsay Navarro is the executive director of El Centro. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us on Out to Lunch Louisiana.
Thank you, Peter. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for joining us for this edition of Out to Lunch Louisiana. We edited these conversations to fit into the time slot here on your NPR station. You can hear longer versions of these conversations wherever you normally get your Out to Lunch podcast. If you're not an Out to Lunch podcast subscriber, search for Out to Lunch Baton Rouge, or Out to Lunch Acadiana on your podcast app.
At some point, we hope to go back to hosting Out to Lunch around the lunch table. But for now, our Lafayette Out to Lunch restaurant, The French Press, is doing curbside takeout. And you can pick up their regular menu items or family dinner, and you can get delivery through Waiter or Grubhub.
In New Orleans, Commander's Palace is closed, but you can have a range of ready-to-cook items shipped from Commander's Kitchen to yours anywhere nationwide. Information is at goldbelly.com.
In Baton Rouge, Mansur's on the Boulevard is open. You can eat at the restaurant where they have 50% occupancy and outdoor dining, or get pickup.
Out to Lunch Louisiana is a production of INO Broadcasting. The producer of our show is Grant Morris. Our technical producer is Eric Merle. And photos from this show on our website and social media are taken by Jill LaFleur. I'm Peter Ricciuti in New Orleans.
I'm Stephanie Regal in Baton Rouge.
And I'm Christian Mader in Lafayette. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you back here next week for more Out to Lunch Louisiana.
Major support for Out to Lunch is provided by the law firm of Jones Walker, established in 1937 with over 375 attorneys in offices throughout the U.S., providing a comprehensive range of services to a local, national, and international client base. JonesWalker.com. And by Hancock Whitney, with more than 120 years of experience helping clients protect the financial future they deserve, even in these challenging times. Hancock Whitney, your dream, our mission. And by Shorten Associates, legal recruiters in Louisiana and Texas. Mitchell Foreman wrote and performs all the music on Out to Lunch. You can hear Mitchell's music anywhere great jazz is sold or streamed, and at MitchellForeman.com.
Harpistry, an eclectic mix of harp-centric world music, Mondays at noon and Sundays at midnight, right here on KRVS.
On the next Arts of Space, electroacoustic sounds for early summer, with music by Patrick O'Hearn, Ludovico Einaudi, Thierry David, and more. I'm Stephen Hill, a program called Mellotronic on the next Arts of Space.
Coming up later tonight at 11, here on KRVS.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.